I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Dr. Michelle McKeough. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Well, I just had to invite you along to do this podcast with me because I saw the words bubonic plague, and I had been writing recently about the establishment of the first Fremantle Hospital, which in its first full decade at the beginning of the 20th century, it had bubonic plague. Amazing. And you've written a book just been published, this fearful plague, bubonic plague in Western Australia, 1900 to 1906. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Getting
Thank
it
you.
Out. And this sounds very biblical, this fearful
That's a quote from one of the Fremantle authorities here who wanted to make sure this fearful plague wasn't introduced into the colony, but they couldn't stop it. It was part of an international pandemic that was travelling at that time throughout the British maritime trading world, and Australia was the last country to get that, in the same way that COVID travelled throughout the world and ended up here. We ended up with the plague in that same fashion, and Western Australia was the last place in Western Australia, in Australia, to get it as well, in the same way COVID sort of played out as at the same way.
Seems to be the value of being a little remote, I suppose.
Yes, yeah, and the fact that we were a working port suggested that we were definitely going to be vulnerable to it. We were certainly vulnerable to the introduction of all sorts of diseases through the port. And so it was sort of travelling internationally, and then it hit Sydney just before it came here, and everyone said, well, if it's in Sydney, it's definitely going to find its way here. Is there anything that we can do to stop it? And they almost immediately introduced precautions in shipping and in the control of rats to try and stop the plague from coming ashore, but it inevitably did, and that was it. We had 6 years of sporadic outbreaks, and then it finished.
Well, it appears that Moses foresaw all of this happening.
Yes.
He spoke about, or somebody did, the fearful plague in Deuteronomy.
Okay.
So that takes you back some thousands of years.
Well, I did not know that, but I'm going to pretend from now on that I'm quoting Deuteronomy instead.
Well, I'm not sure whether praying to the Lord was designed to stop it. I'm sure Moses was much bit practical for that.
Yeah.
He invented a whole lot of other health measures, I think, to stop things spreading. But where did this bubonic plague originate from? Do we know that, before it got here eventually?
Well, before it came here, it had... I'm not actually sure where it originated, but China, India, Indonesia had all had devastating outbreaks because their populations were so large. Everywhere that had the plague on this sort of... on its travels throughout the world, was susceptible to the disease because of overcrowding and poor sanitary conditions.
And that's the sort of ideal circumstances for it to
yes.
set in.
So in those circumstances, you have rats, and when you have rats, you're vulnerable to plague. So in Fremantle, the plague landed here at the shore and at the port, and the only people who contracted the plague in Fremantle lived or worked in the West End, and then when it travelled to Perth, the same thing applied. All the people who had the plague from Perth were in an area bounded by Wellington Street, Hay Street, Pier Street and William Street, and yeah, so there was the overcrowded tenements, poor sanitation.
And this is where rats get a deserved bad rap, I
yeah.
take it. They're the conveyors, the purveyors.
That's
the,
right, of the flea.
The vectors.
Mm, that's correct, yes. So there were a lot of... There was one of the places in Fremantle, one of the early cases where a young boy died, and there were 30 rat holes in one room. So what it highlighted in the end was a need for us to improve the level of sanitation here in Fremantle.
If you didn't have a Pied Piper, that is, to lead the rats and everybody
away. Yeah. Well, they tried. We had a local doctor called Dr. Hope. You've probably come across him.
Indeed, I have.
Yes.
Very well known in the early days of the Fremantle Hospital.
Yes. So he was strident and very clear. Without rats, we won't have plague. But getting people galvanised and actually doing something about it was another thing. They did introduce a rat-catching program where you could hand in dead rats for a sixpence. But the Fremantle public didn't engage in that with much fervour. But if you think about it, sending your children out or going out and touching plague-ridden rats is really something that you'd not very keen
the authorities
to do,
so, hadn't worked through that.
It took them a while, and then they suddenly said, we're basically paying for, you know, children to put rats in their pockets and you know, risk their lives. And when the penny dropped, they sort of went, oh, we'd better not do that anymore.
Financial incentives over the course of time always seem to finish up with some bad policy outcomes. Yes. We don't have to mention pink bats. We've encouraged people to build houses madly during the COVID. Now we've got all these people complaining about the building quality that's come along.
And yes.
There's always these unintended, unthought out, you might say, consequences.
They in the later years of the plague, they introduced what they called plague barometers, which were guinea pigs. And because guinea pigs are even more susceptible to the rat flea than the rat, the plague flea, I should say, they said, well, where rats are fairly common, let's put guinea pigs in cages. If they're dying, we know that the plague flea is present and we can sort of start cleaning up that area. It's an incredibly inhumane, well, I don't know if you can use the word inhumane for animals, but unkind.
Well, there are people who say, I think you can.
Yeah.
It's in animal.
Yes, it was a bit nasty.
And the guinea pigs permit me to say this, became the canary in the cage.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. They also introduced importing ferrets from Melbourne, and they had ferret minders and who had to look after the ferrets. This was mostly in Perth, though, rather than Fremantle. And they'd, you know, walk along and take the ferrets along the wharves and the river foreshore, and the ferrets would ferret out the rats and get them that way.
Now, this happened at a time in Fremantle when the inner harbour, as we call it, Victoria Quay, was all being built and opened.
Yeah, so it almost immediately followed the opening of the harbour in a way. So the opening of the harbour allowed us to improve our shipping, and with that increase in shipping, quite naturally followed the increase of disease brought in from overseas, so, or from the eastern states.
So the rats could literally run straight off, off the gangplank.
Yeah. So what they did, the plague was monitored by what we had then was called the Central Board of Health, which is now the Public Health Department, but it was called the Central Board of Health at that stage, and they had control over a disease that was going to affect the state as a whole. So locally, you had the local Board of Health who managed sort of local, but the Fremantle Harbour had a really strange sort of chaos of authority. So the Central Board of Health monitored quarantine, but only quarantine where the passengers were involved. The Customs Department had control of quarantine where the ships were involved. The Railway Department had control of the wharves and jetties. And the local Board of Health had control over sanitation, but only until the edge of the river. And then the harbour master had control over the other aspects of shipping. So if you were trying to keep a ship off the wharf for the purposes of not allowing rats on shore, you had to deal with five different departments to get authority to do it. And you can imagine the sort of unwillingness of government departments to cooperate with each other and be told what to do. And so it was all a little bit of a mess. And that, once again, the plague highlighted that situation really couldn't continue if you wanted to have some sort of seamless control over quarantine and health. And so the introduction of the Harbour Trust came about, yeah.
And in 1901, of course, Australia as a new nation Federation, happened, yeah. The Commonwealth and the states divvied up power, and that complicated things even more.
Yeah, so...
Customs in the hand of
the federals. So the place in Woodman's Point, where all the quarantine station, was also divided. So the Central Board of Health had the most control, but the actual quarantine station was in the hands of the quarantine department, which was a different body. But that didn't cause too many problems. I think the Central Board of Health were pretty well allowed to have the run of how to deal with the contacts from the plague patients and the plague patients themselves.
So, just looking at the dates, when did we first hear in Freo become aware of the bubonic plague?
April 1900 was the first plague case, and then we had, and that was a fairly short outbreak, and it was contained to Fremantle. The first three people, because we weren't ready for it, all died, but the second three plague cases survived. There was an inoculation that had been developed in India during this sort of plague pandemic. And so if they caught you early, they could give you an injection and your plague symptoms would be fairly minor and you could survive. You could be inoculated and simply not get it. But if they caught it too late, then you had a fairly rapid and painful death. And I'm sorry, I've digressed. You asked for dates. It started in April 1900. It finished in June 1906. With just a few, cases each year, there was an outbreak and then it would sort of dwindle away. And 1905, there had no cases at all in Western Australia.
I'm sure every young and old epidemiologist has been versed in all of this ever since. I mean, not many years afterwards, we get the Spanish plague at the end of
the Spanish flu.
Yeah. But before that, indeed, I think the new first Fremantle Hospital is established in 1897, but as soon as they opened, they've got a whole lot of typhoid cases.
Typhoid was continually present. So we actually mentioned this in here. One of the interesting things about typhoid is it's weather driven, so you're susceptible to the weather. So when we had a particularly bad outbreak at one stage, the doctors were saying as soon as the heavy rains come, it'll all be over because the rains filled the wells and cleaned the ground. And so people were really used to living with that sort of level of disease here in Fremantle. So that at typhoid, however, because there were continued outbreaks of it and the initial symptoms were really similar to plague symptoms, so often people assumed that a patient had typhoid and were treated in that way rather than...
It was misdiagnosed quite often.
Yeah, so quite a few times, yeah.
So how did, leaving aside the quarantining authorities, the Board of Health, I mean, how did the doctors, the nurses all cope with this? And there must also be a risk if you don't handle these things properly, like a parent sending out the kid to earn their sixpence, that they'll catch it.
Yes, that's right. Well, we were really lucky in Western Australia. In Sydney, the plague was being handled by a man called Dr. Ashburton Thompson, and he had a lot of plague experience from overseas. And so when the plague hit Western Australia, he recommended another doctor that he knew called Ernest Black, who had also experience overseas with the plague. And so he was immediately given the job of president of the Central Board of Health. And so under his direction, Western Australia actually managed to have a pretty mild outbreak, really, because he came in and just took charge and he knew what he was doing. We also had local doctors who were really switched on and who had educated themselves on the plague, among them Dr. Hope. So we had, in terms of the triangle of authority, we had really good medical practitioners who were very switched on to what needed to be done. And of course, all of the doctors weren't, they knew that the flea had a big role to play, but it was new knowledge, so it didn't disseminate all the way through the medical fraternity. So there were a few little hiccups where doctors weren't quite sure what they were dealing with, but for the most part, we were very, very lucky.
In terms of casualties, people who died, how big were the numbers?
So over the 6-year period, 81 people contracted the plague, and of them, only 35 died. So it was less than 50%.
Yes. And how far afield did the plague go?
Only Perth and Fremantle, aside from one really virulent outbreak in Geraldton, which was short and sharp and quite nasty. So they actually had 10 plague victims, 8 of whom died, but 6 of them in a 10-day period. And the first two, they were only posthumously recognised as having died of plague. So actually it might only have been one who survived. It might be 9 deaths. I might be misremembering that. But Geraldton didn't get it because of rats visiting. They actually, somebody had brought into town some old flour sacks that had fleas in them.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, so that's how that...
So that would have been flour imported into the colony, possibly through the Geraldton port, goes to a farmer or a townsperson, or and through the dissemination of the flour, flea, which is the contaminating thing, gets out and nips you.
That's right, and it could have just come up from... They were just the sacks. They could have come up from Perth or Fremantle. But, so that caused a very nasty outbreak in Geraldton. But the authorities were absolutely dedicated to making sure that the rats didn't leave from either city, Fremantle or Perth, to get specifically to the goldfields, but to the vulnerable country areas. So.
Well, and we forget that everything... Here we are in the west end of Fremantle today, all the gold rush buildings, everything was happening.
Yep.
People were arriving not only in Fremantle with their stuff for going and finding gold, they were landing at Esperance, they were slightly around the same time, they were landing at Geraldton and finding their way into the Gascoyne and the Murchison. Yep. And all of this is happening. It would have been terrible.
And this is the thing, so Fremantle was incredibly overcrowded because of the new arrivals from the gold rush. And one of the reasons that sanitation was so poor here in the West End was that very thing. And had the plague reached the gold fields, it would have had a really devastating impact on Western Australia. So they were very successful in making sure it didn't get out there.
Now, you've reminded me that there were a lot of people apparently living in tents in Fremantle that were so overcrowded.
Yeah, but the tent city, which was on the outskirts of town, didn't get the plague.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, it was only literally here in the West End, because people were coming into the harbour, they had to leave, you know, via this sort of part of the world, they were coming in and out off the... So this is where crude adaptations to buildings were just tacked on really haphazardly without any sort of consideration for health and comfort, and the sanitation wasn't ready to take on the influx of all the population, so it became became absolutely overburdened, and so you had, you know, effluent spilling out into the streets, and the stench apparently of the West End at this time was... Certain parts of it were quite unbearable. People were complaining about the noxious smells repeatedly, and having to sort of cross alleyways that were filled with, you know, human effluent as well as horse manure and, you know, rainwater, and it was quite sort of
dramatic. So poor
old
Fremantle gets this early reputation. I think it probably predates those events as well, as a place where you wouldn't go if you want a pleasant Sunday afternoon out, and you don't want your kids to go and live in Fremantle either.
That's right. One of the comments to the newspapers was Fremantle was described as not even a moderately sanitary town. So it had a pretty bad rep. And it had a bad rep, as you said, for quite a while before the plague came, but it certainly increased during these years,
Grubby and dirty, people reckon today.
Yeah.
Oh, well, goodness gracious. Where was that tent city
out. There was one in North Fremantle, and there was one out. Well, they call it Plimpton, you know.
Up in East Fremantle, up that way.
So I know there was one in North Fremantle, and I'm going to limit my description of where the other one was because I picture it out sort of near where the rainbow containers are now, in that area there. But I could be wrong. I know I haven't researched that, so I don't want to be. I don't want people ringing you and saying she has no idea what she's talking about.
Well, we'll invite our listeners to tell us more precisely.
Yes.
And how did they actually respond and knock it all over by 1906?
It's a modern day miracle. It's the same as anything else. We got on to rat destruction, to cleanliness. We started tarring the backyard. So here in the West End, you have noticed that, you know, where one building shares a yard space with the building on the other side, those dirt backyards were absolutely vulnerable to the plague conditions, where, you know, you could have 15 adults and 12 children sharing two toilets in these little dirt backyards, more often than not stables right next to it. And so they said, right, that we can't continue like this, we have to get in. And they just went block by block and started tarring all of these backyards. They replaced all the wooden drains, so you can imagine wood absorbs anything that sort of hits it. And so they, because they were so overburdened, were unable to sort of take the amount of stuff that was pouring into them. And so they replaced all the wooden drains with concrete drains. They started introducing building codes, which we just simply didn't have before. So that where the number of toilets per building, the ventilation was a really big important introduction of better levels of ventilation in a building. And so these building codes were enacted in those last few years of the plague, so that by the time we got to 1906, there were a lot of serious improvements to our the way we actually lived. A lot of buildings got demolished, and the new ones that were put up were had to follow the new regulations.
In terms of other outcomes, I mean, you'd like to think that from every disaster we learn something. What else did we appear to learn?
To have a rubbish service. That was something we take for granted now, but that came about because of the plague. We just didn't have a regular rubbish refuse service, you know. And water had long been, and I'm sure you're right across this, water had long been a problem in Fremantle. And the health authorities had been crying out for an improved water supply for a really long time. So the plague was able to highlight that need, and they immediately began making a better water supply to Fremantle, beginning in the West End. They also they had better systems of reporting of disease and that sort of thing as well. So just sort of generally paying more attention to our level of sanitation and the way we sort of, in the same way COVID has done now, makes us a bit more aware of how we live around each other.
It's interesting that you mentioned COVID. A lot of us didn't know the word epidemiology until COVID came along. We discovered there are these people who have these specialist practices in medicine and medical research, epidemiologists. And some of them become sort of quite famous commentators about what's going on around us. And we become aware of quarantine powers that exist. We're aware of them for agriculture, but often not for other things. Do you think there was a period after the plague, we've already mentioned the Spanish flu, where into the 20th century we forgot these lessons and we've only been reminded about all of this now? Or was it all in place when COVID came along?
No, I think COVID is following a lot of the same administrative procedures that were established during the plague, and we've had to use them from time to time when there've been other outbreaks like the Spanish flu, but we haven't had that international and high level of contagion like we did with something like the plague, except for, you know, we have small outbursts that are locally contained, but we haven't been part of that international. I mean, there have been a few diseases over those years, but the swine flu and the, you know, a few others, but they seem to have been swiftly managed and eradicated. So I think the closest relationship to COVID is the plague. Mm, yeah,
it's amazing. And Michelle, how did you come to find your way to the plague? What was you doing when this light bulb moment occurred? Yes. And the plague presented itself as some sort of gift to
yes,
you?
Yes, it was a gift. I was just at the beginning of my research into Fremantle for my PhD, and thinking I was going to sort of move into a social history. That's where I wandered. I had the good fortune to have Geoffrey Bolton as my supervisor, and he and I were sort of just working out what shape the PhD might take, and we thought we'd be guided by what we found in the archives.
This is a social history of Fremantle?
Social history of Fremantle, that was the intention.
Yes.
Yeah, and then just saw a reference to the bubonic plague in one of the council archives and just started pulling on that string, and all of a sudden discovered that there'd been this enormous outbreak of bubonic plague that no one had written about. So in 1926, the director for quarantine had written a book about the plague in Australia, and he basically just listed the plague patients, and that was it.
So patients?
Just the plague. So he had in his records the death records of the whoever died of the plague, and he just listed them in his book. So, and he looked a bit into the epidemiology that brought it here, but that was the only thing that's been ever written about the plague in Western Australia. So mm-hmm. this beautiful uncovering. The State Records Office, the people there are just amazing, and they were just bringing out boxes and letting me go through boxes of unopened, you know, records, and it's just been absolutely fantastic, you know.
They've been waiting for you to arrive.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about that research. What sorts of records were you uncovering?
So the local health authority, obviously, and the local council, which are
Fremantle-based.
Fremantle, yep. And then, of course, then that onto the Central Board of Health records. And the Central Board of Health had to report to the Colonial Secretary. So there's obviously Colonial Secretary. And then within that, there are small events that have happened where the police needed to be involved. So there's police records as well. And then I've used newspapers because they are so colourful. So they're quite happy to describe something in a way that a you know, your town clerk isn't going to describe, a little bit more bluntly. So they've added quite a lot of colour, which is great. So they're the most of the records. Here and there, you know, it drifts out where other agencies have been involved, but they're the bulk of where the research comes from.
For many colonial settler European people who died in the earlier days. Mm. We've even got headstones to memorialise them by now up in Fremantle. Do you find died of the bubonic plague on any headstones round about?
No. And actually there weren't any sort of significant, not like, you know, Boris Johnson? Yeah, getting the plague. We didn't get any sort of notable.
He got COVID, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yes. Getting COVID, I meant to say. But so you'll find that the people who lived and worked in the West End were mostly working at the harbour, and the sort of the wealthy merchants and your the administrators were out of town in, you know, lovely houses that really didn't get rats. They weren't dealing. They had fresh water, and so it was really a working man sort of disease, really. And the same in the city in Perth. All the people that got it there were there because they had to be. They didn't. They would have preferred to have been in the lovely houses out of town. And to our shame, the Aboriginal community weren't allowed into Fremantle in this stage, but that
turned out to be lucky for them.
So no Aboriginal communities got the plague, which is good.
Describe for us then, in a more, if you like, picturesque way. You've mentioned the West End took the brunt of this.
Mm.
What, in a sense, did the West End look like then? I mean, who was living there?
The word ramshackle tenements comes to mind. So all the people who lived and worked here were clustered around the harbour. They called it the West Ward, but it was also considered the main part of town. So Cliff Street, which now here is sort of out of town, was considered almost like a main road in Fremantle, one of the major streets.
Lionel Sampson and Son set up there in 1829 or thereabouts, and still there today.
And the Esplanade. So the Esplanade is another interesting point. So that was where that beautiful park is now, was a foreshore in the days of the plague. And
it was later reclaimed to be what it is today.
Yes. So there were two big box drains outside of off Cliff Street, outside of what's now the Shipwreck Museum. But out there, where that was just beach, there were two big box drains, and they used to put the night soil. So that was, what they got from the toilets, they'd empty it into a cart, put it in the box drains, and send it out to sea. But they didn't go very far out to sea, so quite naturally, all of that stuff was just floating back in, mixing with rotten seaweed on the beach. And what people considered one of the main parts of their town was this stinking, revolting, someone described it as a seething mass of putrefied corruption, which I love that quote. And so as a result of the plague, the council said, okay, you have to wrote to the Premier and said, please give us some money. We need to fix this. This is one of our biggest problems. And so they got the money to reclaim the Esplanade, and now we have this beautiful park.
So thank you, bubonic plague.
Thank you, bubonic plague, yes.
And as you did your research, were there some things that just so took you by surprise along the way?
Yes. There were quite a few things. So, well, but one of them is the Chinese community came in for a lot of rancor and prejudice, which I wasn't expecting. No one got the blame for the plague, except for a small part, the Chinese community at one stage.
What was the size of the Chinese community then?
In Fremantle, it wasn't very big. In Perth, it was more significant, and that's where most of the prejudice was sort of focused, and the attention was focused up there in Perth. In Fremantle, it was a very small, tight-knit community, harbour community, and we just didn't seem to have the sort of prejudices that the larger town of Perth seemed to hold.
And one assumed, as in other parts of Australia, we had riots in Lamington Flats all a time ago, Chinese community in the eastern states. It's often because you have a community, isn't it, that seems to be reasonably close-knit, and if something goes wrong, people say, oh, well, it's their fault. Is that what was happening here?
It didn't happen in Fremantle, but in Perth, there was quite a lot of hostility sort of marked out towards the Chinese community in around. They had King Street. There was a Chinese community around there.
Yes.
Now, but not in Fremantle. It was even though the people of the lowest socioeconomic condition were getting the plague, there was no sort of what a historian in Sydney has called class warfare and a class bias. And so in Sydney, all those places that got the plague of exactly the same socioeconomic status as Fremantle, both situated on the harbour, in Sydney, they were targeted, their houses were torn down en masse, and they were pushed out of town. and the council took over the area near the harbour, and I think by then it was probably, you know, worth a considerable amount of money, as harbourside land is. That didn't happen here in Fremantle. It was
fairly egalitarian, yes, response. What was, yes, the sort of the gender implications? Was it, I suppose, the people who were working and are where the rats are more likely to catch it? Was it predominantly males?
Yeah, it was predominantly males. The women that got it tended to have boarding houses that we talked about, that were sort of overcrowded with Gold Rush patrons. And so but predominantly, yes, they were young working men. That was the other surprise, the youthfulness of probably the majority of the victims, actually. Mm. 19, the first guy that got it was 19, 17-year-olds, 15-year-olds. Yeah, it was a young working man's sort of disease, I suppose, in a way. And only a couple of children, thank goodness. Smattering of women.
I'm assuming, as in any sort of historical inquiry and starting to document it, you think you know a place well, wherever it might be. Let's call it Fremantle. And then you discover all these other things about it. How wide were your eyes widened? How many scales were removed?
Well, I didn't realise that even in the early 1900s, people were still throwing rubbish out of their windows and it was trickling down. You sort of have this Dickensian sort of view of that. That happened in England. It didn't happen here.
Sounds like, but Rome, 2022.
Yeah, exactly. What impressed me the most was this sort of noxious state of affairs in Fremantle, which I had not. And I've been writing about Fremantle history and studying it for some time, which is why I was doing my PhD, and it really took me by surprise. It was chaotic and smelly and you know, the people, you know, there was very little light, and so, you know, lawlessness and that sort of thing was sort of around as well, and a lot of drunkenness, and yeah, Fremantle had this really seedy reputation, and I hadn't quite sort of picked up on the physicalness of that. I knew a bit about the criminality, but I hadn't sort of got a sense of the streets themselves teeming with these people and these smells and these pollution, and that was probably the nicest surprise, to get this sort of full picture.
We sometimes forget that there were a lot of people not that long ago, but who lived in Fremantle. You've mentioned boarding houses. Mm. It was a different world compared to today. I mean, it'd be emptied out after dark, Fremantle.
Yeah, so
we've got some nice, lovely Fremantle music that sounds coming
so
through
nice.
Our window. Yeah.
No, after dark, it was still pretty, pretty active, I think. So I know that the water police used to do night patrols, and so they'd find, you know, drunken sailors and take them back to their ships, and often would get a reward if they managed to get someone back to their ship. And, you know, seamen deserters were pretty common because they were wanting to jump ship and get to the gold fields.
This is the other thing it's so easy to forget about, that the principle, really the only way to get around the world and to arrive easily here in Fremantle was to come by ship.
Yeah.
You could come overland, but that wasn't so easy then.
No, no.
So you have all these people. Not everybody was happy to be on a ship.
Mm.
The rats were happy to get off as well.
Yeah, it's very colourful.
So what's your next project?
My next project is looking at the Depression era. And so obviously a lot more in Fremantle. That was one of the areas I looked at in my PhD, and I really want to flesh that out a lot more. In Fremantle, we had what I've called a civil movement in the absence of state and federal funding. Fremantle really looked after their own. We had single men couldn't get any assistance from the government. You had to be married to get any sort of sustenance. So you had single men sleeping out in the Esplanade Park because they had no means of paying their rent. They had no means of feeding themselves. So we set up soup kitchens. And even though that was mimicked in other areas throughout Australia, and that's something that I really want to look at, but Fremantle really led the way of how to gather a community together and look after people who were desperate. You know, there were families who couldn't put shoes on their kids' feet, couldn't get blankets, and the government took a long time to step in and provide financial assistance. So, Fremantle community really rallied, and I'm very curious to sort of look at that even in more detail.
Well, as we draw this conversation to a close, Michelle, it's going to be really interesting to hear that. I've wondered for a long time, I mentioned Moses earlier, whether we humans ever really evolve in any particular way, whether our technology changes but we don't and the issues remain the same. We have homelessness today, we have epidemics, pandemics. Do you learn anything from history that bears on that issue?
I think very much so. I think if you understand history, you understand that the humans and human nature replay itself over and over and over again, and how we've dealt with a situation well or badly we can learn from. So I think that homelessness at the moment, I think the depression era is going to resonate quite interestingly on how we definitely, and with issues of welfare as well. So I think we're going to find there's a lot of parallels once again.
Well, thank you very much for joining me talking about your new book.
Thank you, Michael.
Will discover when they go on to the story page on the Shipping News just how they can buy it.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me, Michael. Thank you.